The following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
FlyPod.com. I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. Today we have the author of Atlas Obscura. Well, let's talk about the authors first. It's three authors, Joshua Four, Dylan Thuris, and Ella Morton. Well, that's how they're mentioned in the book. We have Dylan Thuris. And right now, Dylan, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
This is like a cool book. This is almost like a world book encyclopedia of places I'd like to go see that I never knew existed.
That's exactly what we hoped it would be, something where you could open it to any page and find an incredible wonder that you'd never heard of and you're surprised even exists.
So how did you come up with the idea of this? Was it you three? Was it somebody else? And they said, hey, let's get you guys doing it? Or
so it was Josh and I, and it really started back in 2009. Part of the reason it came about is Josh and I had worked on a previous project, and I was heading to live in Eastern Europe for a year. I was moving to Budapest. And we started talking about how there wasn't a great travel resource for the kinds of stuff we like to see, this tiny museums or outsider art projects, you know, a castle built by one guy for 20 years. And so right before I headed off, we decided let's start building this thing. And so we started as a website in 2009. And from the very beginning, it was an open platform in the sense that people submit stuff to the site and they say, here's something that I think belongs. It's a very strange location. And I grew up, couple miles from it and not many people know it's there. So it grew from there. Around 2011, we started thinking, you know, it'd be really nice to be able to hold this in your hand. And we started putting the book together.
So how did somebody know that you were looking for places like this? I mean, where was it listed?
On the site, we put out a big kind of call and we said, you know, we are trying to find the great hidden wonders of the world. And pretty much from day one, people understood the kind of stuff we were looking for. Even now, you know, 9 out of 10 or even more than that, 19 out of 20, when people submit stuff, they're on the right track. People know that we're looking for these kind of great stories that might go overlooked or untold, you know, or the house down the street that doesn't look like much, but then someone tells you its background and the crazy things that happen there. And that's a good Atlas Obscura place.
You know, there are a lot of conventions around the, well, around the world, actually, me thinking just about the United States. You know, I know people that drive to these conferences. They are in a certain city, and they want to look for that tombstone, that world's largest ball of rubber bands or something strange. This would be right up their alley.
It would be. It would be. And that's who I am as well. When I come to a city, I want to find the kinds of places that maybe don't make it into the normal guidebooks, but kind of tell you something about the city. Sometimes these stranger places, by looking at the fringes, you get a more complete picture of the whole. And so, yeah, this would be right up their alley. And we also cover the whole world because it's not just American roadside stuff that's out there, but all kinds of incredible things really anywhere you go.
So in your bucket list, do you have looking at different places in Atlas Obscura and saying, you know, I want to do so many of this, maybe a percent of maybe what's in there. What's your bucket list?
Oh, man. There was a day when I realized we had too many places on the website to go in a lifetime. I did the math and I was like, oh, I'd have to go to three places every day for the next 30 years. I was like, that's going to be tough. That's a really tall order. There are plenty of places. And in a way, you know, it's not just about, in a way, it's more of a framework of looking at the world as much as it is a bucket list of places. So there are places I absolutely want to go. There's a place in Turkmenistan called the Gates of Hell, which is one of my favorite places in the world that I haven't yet actually been to. And it is a 200-foot wide hole in the middle of the desert. And the way it came to be is in 1979, a Soviet petroleum drilling rig set up. They were trying to drill for natural gas, and they found it. But they made a mistake. They set up on top of a basically a huge bubble, a big cavern. So when they started drilling, it collapsed in, the whole rig collapsed in, and they created this enormous hole in the middle of the desert. And they had sort of a secondary problem, which is that the hole was leaking deadly natural gas. So they did what I think they thought was the sensible thing to do. They lit the hole on fire. And they thought it would burn for maybe a few weeks or a few months, but 40-plus years later, it is still on fire. It's on fire now as we talk to one another. It's one of these strange places in the world. When someone tells you there's a giant flaming hole in the desert that's been on fire for 40 years, you think, well, A, that's very interesting, and B, I'm sort of surprised that I wasn't aware of that previously. So there's a place I'd like to go. But ultimately, it's not just these kind of far-flung places. The longer I've done this, the more I've realized, A, these sort of wondrous stories are all around us, and B, a lot of it's about kind of approaching a city or travel almost less with a bucket list and more with a real sense of active curiosity, asking a lot of questions, maybe be willing to get lost, meander, go in some strange-looking door and start saying, oh, what is this building? How did this get here? And so, yeah.
So Atlas Obscura, if I'm maybe driving around, maybe going from coast to coast, and I see these signs, maybe it's like the largest porch swing, the world's tallest something. I mean, is that some of the things that you look for here?
Sure. Yeah, we absolutely cover, sort of classic American roadside attractions. And I grew up in the Midwest. I grew up in Minneapolis, and my parents would take me on these long, kind of classically Midwestern road trips where, every site is 8 hours from the next thing. And we went to these kinds of locations, around when I was 12. So places like Waldrug, which is, this kind of classic roadside attraction, or the Corn Palace in South Dakota, a place called House on the Rock in Wisconsin, which is, to my mind, maybe the greatest single roadside attraction in the U.S. It's a kind of a never-ending museum of museums. It's got a giant squid fighting a whale the size of the Statue of Liberty inside the museum. It's hard to explain. It's weirder than you can ever really convey to people. Anyway, that kind of set a little bit of a blueprint for me. So that stuff definitely makes it in the book, absolutely. And the thing I like to get at is, it's easy to sort of say, oh, that's weird, a giant ball of twine, that's sort of quirky. But what's more interesting is the story, especially kind of the people behind some of these things. Why did this person spend 40 years rolling the ball of twine? There's, in fact, a very heated giant ball of twine debate, basically, of who really has the biggest one. Depends on whether you do it by volume or weight. Depends on whether it was rolled by one person or a group. As you dive deeper into these things that at first glance might just seem like kind of trivia or quirk, they actually often reveal like a deep, fascinating story. And they, often they relate to the history of their location or America.
It sounds like a little twine envy going on.
Oh, that's what that sounds like. And there is, yeah.
Minneapolis, I did not get to this place, but I know that you have a gravesite that it was pretty much a famous guy with a ukulele, and his name was Tiny Tim, and he's buried in Minneapolis. Does something like that make Atlas Obscura?
Yeah. Gravesites can be can be a tough call because there's obviously a lot of them and you could get sort of overwhelmed. It's a question of whether there's a great story behind both the person and sometimes the site itself, so is actually the grave kind of an interesting location beyond just marking this person's spot of burial. We have actually quite a few gravestones, although usually there's something about them that makes them strange. There's one in Oklahoma, which is basically it's a monument to a circus that set up during a thunderstorm. And I don't remember the exact number, but six people were killed when they were trying to set up the poles and lightning struck. And so they have this kind of recreation of a jagged, broken circus tent pole with a lightning etched on it. And it was made in the late 1800s. And so that's the kind of place that certainly makes it into the Atlas Obscura.
I could think of maybe another one. I don't know if it's in here or not, but there's a man that was buried inside his Mercedes or something like that, I think.
Sure.
At some point.
Yeah, there's a strong tradition in Africa of making beautiful custom coffins. We have this coffin workshop. So you too could be buried inside of a Mercedes should you want to be.
Atlas Obscura, of course, all around the world. How many places, have you counted how many places you have listed in Atlas Obscura?
Yeah, the site has, I can't give you a specific number because it's literally changing every day, but it's well over 10,000. The book, we decided to basically distill that 10,000, which is broader, more expansive, into kind of the best of the best. So this has about 700 places in it, the stuff that we just thought was absolutely kind of eye-opening and incredible.
You have something from every country?
So it's interesting. It was very hard to balance we tried to cover as many countries as we could. We do not have something from every single country. There are a few that, for whatever reason, we didn't think the things that we had there should make the cut. So there's a few that got left out, sadly.
Maybe because they're kind of dangerous countries or?
It's not that. There are places in this book where we have kind of a disclaimer that says this isn't necessarily meant to be treated like a Lonely Planet guide. You know, some of these places are complicated for many different reasons. So there are places in this book that are sites of environmental disaster, and you wouldn't necessarily want to make a beeline to them, or, you know, various things about them make them not practical to travel to. We have a big section on Antarctica, for example, and there are places, there's a great place called Blood Falls in Antarctica, which is a giant 3-story frozen blood red waterfall that's leaking essentially extremophile bacteria that have been trapped under this glacier for 3 million years. It's amazing. It's very unlikely that you're going to make a trip there unless you're part of a scientific team. But the point was more to kind of give you a breath, really show you the expansive possibilities of what's out there in this world. And hopefully when you kind of get that sense, it opens up what you think is possible to find, and hopefully kind of also shows you that it's not just in Antarctica and it's not just in Turkmenistan.
Dylan, you were telling me that you and Joshua, you guys collaborated on something else at one point.
Yes. We started in a similar vein. We put on an event together called the First Annual Proceedings of the Athanasius Kircher Society. It was also the last proceedings of such a thing. He was... Kircher was a 17th century Jesuit priest who was sometimes called the last man to know everything. And he was a polymath, kind of into everything, lowered himself into a volcano to find out about volcanoes. Anyway, we put on an event that was sort of an evening of wonders, kind of a collection of incredible people and incredible performances. So a guy named Kim Peek, who was the inspiration for Rain Man, was there with his father, and Kim did a kind of memory demonstration because he has a unique ability to essentially a quote-unquote photographic memory. And a guy named Colonel Joe Kittinger was there, who was at that point still it's since been broken, but he was then the record holder for the world's longest free fall in the early days of NASA, really before it existed. He got sent up in a weather balloon, basically to the very edge of the atmosphere, and leaped out. There's 16 millimeter film of him stepping off, you know, this hot air balloon, basically, and falling towards Earth. And his story was incredible. The first time went really badly. And anyway, so we, you know, Josh and I have always both been interested. This is what brought us together in the strangeness of history and the idea that the world and the past are much weirder. And I mean, they're truly a different country and they're truly an alien world. And so kind of exploring that idea and expanding people's sense of what's possible in the world.
Atlas Obscura. I mean, it's the first book together for you, Ella, and Josh. Are you guys like looking at maybe doing another book like this?
Yes. We are still kind of figuring that out, and I won't say too much because I think we're still in the brainstorming process. But yeah, we would like to do another large book covering the world with a geographical focus. But the thing that's interesting is, again, this is a frame of seeing. So you could do, for example, you could do a version of Atlas Obscura that was really oriented around science and technology and these kinds of incredible sites, you know, where things are happening. People don't know that there's a giant fusion reactor being built called ITER. And so you could do like a whole book like that. So we're kind of figuring out what we want the next frame for the world to be.
Yeah, you know, like some of those atom splitters and everything. I mean, and even with the nuclear bomb that they first let off, they thought it could have been the end of the world as we know it, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, and that, there's a whole – we've written about this on the site some, the rich and fascinating world of atomic tourism. You know, there's a whole world of basically going to these sites, and I'm fascinated by this history as well. I've one of the places I also is on my, I guess my bucket list, I would say is the Trinity site. You know, this first where they created this layer of Trinitanium, which is basically the glass. The sand just turned all to a kind of radioactive glass. You're not supposed to take it for obvious reasons. But they only open up the site 2 days a year. One of those days I'm going to be there.
I wonder how many people actually pick up a hunk of glass.
I bet you a lot. I think a lot of them has actually gone missing in people's pockets and are slowly releasing small amounts of radiation into their home somewhere. Maybe they have them in lead cases. I don't know. Who knows?
Atlas Obscura, of course, I mentioned this in the beginning, that it kind of reminds me of the old encyclopedias. And every year you would get that brand new edition that would update everything. And this seems almost like that. Of course, the Encyclopedia Britannica and other books like that.
Old reference books, yeah.
They're pretty much gone, aren't they?
They are, although I have a deep love for them. I have a deep love for sort of old reference books and children's encyclopedias and sort of scientific encyclopedias. And, you know, I think there's a place for – the idea with those books, too, was to inspire a sense of wonder in the world. And I think, unfortunately, people started seeing those as basically kind of these monotonous, boring, you know, they felt duty-bound to kind of have one and would never crack it open because they had other ways to get some of that information. But also, I think the connection between those as a generator for wonder and amazement in the world kind of went away. And so I think there's a place for that. I think there's a place for books that, when you open up, they astonish you and they make you sort of engage with the world's true odd magnificence. And that's, you know, that's what we hope this book does for people.
You know, I think with the yearly books like that, of course, the next year they were pretty much out of date because, you know, hey, they already put a man on the moon. Well, now the second and third person's been up there and the book's out of date. With Atlas Obscura, I mean, I don't think this thing would ever go out of date, would it?
There'll be things that we have to change, you know, when we release sort of a new edition, stuff will close. Certain things that are fragile in some way, you know, things may get destroyed. One thing we found in working on Atlas Obscura is that, you know, we really, part of why we did this is we really love these places. And we love the outsider art projects. We love these small museums. But a lot of them are fragile and they disappear largely from being underloved, not from being sort of loved to death. So, you know, hopefully not too many, but there are already, you know, there are things that I think we will have to kind of update, make small corrections on. And you know, I was just thinking of a place in Vermont, a guy named Knight's Spiderweb Farm. And he does this amazing thing where he basically has a barn filled with spiders and he manages to capture the spiderwebs on sort of canvases, essentially, and kind of freeze them in time and you can go buy one. And they had a fire recently. And so a lot of it was destroyed. They're rebuilding it now. So hopefully by the time we've reprinted this book, we actually won't have to change anything at all. But it is a little bit of a moving target. And, you know, part of this idea too is like some of these places, getting to them or finding their open hours is like a little bit of a challenge. But that's also, we think we have a kind of self-selecting audience for people who are willing to drive a little bit out of their way or call ahead or make an appointment to see some of this stuff. So,
you know, I could see if you were going to Budapest, so you would look in here and you would say, ah, oh, what kind of cool things can I see? Maybe off the beaten path a lot. Most touristy things, they will show you just a certain thing, but if you wanted to maybe go your own way, you could pretty much find out different things in here and see it, I guess. Is that?
That's absolutely right. It's sort of a jumping off point for your travels. And again, the book sort of represents the absolute best of the best and we treated it as a parallel project to the website. So we sort of, everything in the book has been independently researched and fact checked and rewritten and, but, you know, the idea is this is a kind of beginning. And you can also, the site is there as well to provide another kind of resource for travel planning. Yeah, but the idea is you could absolutely look at this and hopefully find something to add to your travel that will probably, if we've done our job, be the thing that you really remember and talk about when you return from your trip.
So you could say, well, you know, I went to Egypt, I saw the pyramids. Oh, yeah, but did you see, like, the Hall of the Skulls or something?
Yeah,
you know?
The Cairo Agricultural Museum, which no one would go to, but is this kind of totally incredible, slightly decrepit museum, you know, in this, in a kind of not great neighborhood of the city. So, and that will be the thing that when you tell the stories, that'll be the thing you tell the stories about. Yeah. There's a good example in Florence that I think of, which is there's the Uffizi, which is on almost every tourist list, and they spend hours waiting in line. Sometimes, whether they sort of actually want to see it or not, they just know that they're sort of supposed to see it. Then they,
I'm supposed to go.
Right. They dutifully walk through the Renaissance paintings and, you know, not, and no knock on the Uffizi. It's totally incredible and it's worth going to. But if they went around the corner into the History of Science Museum in Florence, among all these kinds of lodestones and armillary spheres and telescopes, it's worth it just for that. They would find a little glass egg with a small human fragment that is Galileo's middle finger. So
really?
That is around the corner. They can walk 10 minutes up the way over the bridge, the Ponte Vecchio, and they can go to a museum called La Specula, which has a collection of wax anatomical models, which were meant to train doctors before they really, before there were enough cadavers to go around to do dissections. So they basically made these models and they're like nothing you've ever seen. They're beautiful works of art. They're kind of grotesque. They're also fascinating. They're really wonderful. These are the things that you want to, you know, and it's sort of, it doesn't, hopefully all of this serves as a slight nudge to tell people, you know, get a little bit outside of the top 10, go around the corner, there'll be something worth seeing there.
I'm intrigued about this middle finger. I mean, it's, I mean, they didn't really have plastic at the time or anything, and
no,
in glass it would have just burned up, I would have thought.
No, it's a mummified, it's mummified, basically. It's, and it was.
Give him this finger.
Yeah.
Put this.
You're right. Exactly. Exactly. It was taken off of Galileo's, sort of skeletal remains about 100 years after he died.
Right.
By an admirer, someone who wanted to sort of give him the same veneration that you might give a Catholic saint. And it kind of floated around for a while and eventually ended up in the History of Science Museum. But it is a question, right? I mean, Galileo had this complicated relationship with the church. He was a believer. He believed in God. He saw the beauty of the heavens in mathematics and astronomy. But obviously he was also put on house arrest for 20 years by the Pope. So who, what that, where that middle finger is pointing, you know?
And he's still giving them that.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, well, Atlas Obscure, I think that the book also would be, and, you know, not only is it fantastic just to have it home and just kind of look through it and dream of different places you could go, find out about different places, but, I mean, for me, where I'm at, I mean, I'm sure that you are able to do day trips with what you find in here, you know, several hundred miles away, you could have a day trip.
That's absolutely right. It is a lot more close at hand than I think most people realize.
Well, there are different castles around the country. I know I was in Lexington, Kentucky one time and just out by the horse racing facility. I think it was around Keeneland. There was a big castle there somebody built for their wife.
Wow. I'm not sure. We probably have it on the site. I don't know it off the top of my head. There is a kind of a self-built castles tradition here in the U.S. There's a kind of a castle built mostly from garbage called Kano's Castle. I believe that's in Colorado. Also in Colorado, actually, is Bishop Castle, which is one of the great pieces of outsider art in the entire country. And it's a 16-story stone castle in the sort of a medieval-ish style. It's got a metal fire-breathing dragon on top of it. And at the very top, there are these, like wrought iron little bridges and kind of a sphere, a wrought iron ball that you can get into. I went there with my wife and we climbed around in the winter and it was a totally incredible, slightly harrowing experience. You sign something and there's a guest book that basically says, if you sign this and then you die, it's, you have admitted that this is not our fault, that this is your fault and that you're on your own. And there was something kind of refreshing about that, honestly, the kind of idea of, right. This is, it's, you're a little on your own recognizance there.
So, you know, talking about castles, I would think that the eastern part of the U.S. is the older part. Are there more castles on the eastern part of the United States as opposed to other places?
Well, there are no real castles. You know, there's nothing. Any castle that's here is either someone's self-built project, or there are a few examples where millionaires, you know, sort of golden age barons of industry brought an entire castle and then reconstructed it somewhere. I would guess that there might be more on the East Coast just because that's where more of the wealth was during that period. But, you know, the distribution of castles in America is basically scattershot because they're not native to the U.S. in any kind of way.
Well, I guess I won't be looking for a castle to move into anytime soon around here. Atlas Obscura, of course, the brand new book by Joshua Foer, Dylan Thuris, who we have in studio, and Ella Morton. If I were to go to the website, what website will I look for and what am I going to see?
Well, we are atlasobscura.com, and you can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Atlas Obscura. And you'll see on the site, you'll see both a database of 10,000 plus places all over the world. That's a good place to sort of plug in your zip code, and you'll oftentimes people are surprised. One of the sort of best piece of feedback we get is, I've lived here 20 years and I never knew this was here, and it's 2 miles from my house. That kind of thing is really wonderful to hear. It makes us feel like we're doing our job. But we also write a lot of original articles too. So we sometimes we do big maps. We did a fun map of all of the pun business names in America, or as many as we could collect, which was thousands. Thai food restaurants and Vietnamese restaurants are very big on it. Hair salons. Turns out that there are numerous curl up and dyes hair salons, you know. So
are there any walk the dogs?
Walk the dogs. What do you mean?
That'd be like a Chinese food restaurant.
Oh, walk the W-O-K. Oh, of course. Why? Maybe. There should be. You know, yeah, a lot of like typhoons and things like that. Titanic.
Are those places more successful with those creative names?
That I could not tell you. I like to believe, yes, they are more successful with me. I will go to a restaurant just based on a really terrible groaner of a pun. But so we do stuff like that. We write about linguistics, about, you know, sort of why certain accents sound the way they do. We write about a lot of things that sort of just enrich your understanding of the world around you.
So, and that website again?
AtlasObscura.com.
All right, Atlas Obscura. You know, I got this book, looking through it, several places I'd like to go. I'm looking for maybe even a day trip. I think the biggest ball of twine is close by from where I'm at, which is maybe 100 or 200 miles away. When I travel across country, I'm going to have this book, Atlas Obscura, by my side. Dylan, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Been listening to Cover to Cover. I'm Mark DeWitt. That was Atlas Obscura, written by Joshua Foer, Ella Morton, and who you were listening to, Dylan Thuris.
To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.